Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 96 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the novelist Monique Roffey speaks with Carol Angier about the Caribbean and biographical roots of her early novels, including the starring role of an ordinary bicycle and unique local patois.
Monique Roffey was born in 1965 in Port of Spain, Trinidad. She was educated in England from her early teens, first at a convent boarding school in Weybridge in Surrey, and then at UEA. After university, she worked as a journalist and as a human rights activist in the Middle East Department of Amnesty International. In 1999 to 2000, she took a creative writing MA at Lancaster University, and from then on, she's led a literary life. From 2002 to 6, she was a co-centre director at Arvon's Totley Barton Centre. She's taught for Arvon, for the Skyros Writers Lab, and for English Pen. She's been Royal Literary Fund Fellow at the Universities of Sussex, Chichester, and Greenwich, and she has taught on the Creative Writing MA at Goldsmiths College. She now teaches privately in Trinidad and at COSTAT, a government-run college in Port of Spain. She is the author of four novels and a memoir. Her books are Sundog, 2002, The White Woman on the Green Bicycle, 2009, which was shortlisted for the Orange Prize in 2010 and the Encore Award in 2011. With the Kisses of His Mouth, her memoir, 2011. Archipelago, 2012, which won the OCM BOCAS Award for Caribbean Literature in 2013. And was shortlisted for the Orion Award in 2014, and The House of Ashes, recently published in 2014. So, Monique, how did it all start? Are you one of those writers who always wanted to write, you know, who were writing from age of 7 or 11, or did it come to you later?
I would say early on I didn't ever have this notion of wanting to write. I was writing from an early age. So I was writing from a child. I always wrote stories. I remember I used to write all over the walls of my room and all over the walls of our house as well. And I just used to write. I wrote a lot as a kid. By the time I was 15 or 16, I won the English Prize at school, at the convent boarding school. And in those days, you were streamed. You had the Oxbridge brainy class, the clever girls class. You had the naughty girls class, and then you had the B stream in the middle. If you got an A in Latin, you would go into the clever girls class. And I got my A in Latin, but I didn't want to go into the clever girls class because they all looked about 45. And I didn't like them at all, didn't like the look of these clever girls. So I stayed in my B stream, and every year you would have these prizes, and every year all the prizes were won by the clever girls, by the A class. And then when I got to fifth year and the prizes were announced for, you know, the various subjects, it was always one of those events where you wouldn't even think of bothering. And in my fifth form, I won a prize. I was the only person who'd ever won any kind of prize outside of that class, and it was for English. By the time I was 15, I was obsessed with poetry, prose, playwriting. I was writing compositions. I never thought to myself, I want to be a writer, I'm going to be a writer. It was just an obsession. So, and then I think I became a journalist in my 20s, put literary aspirations, weren't even a concern. I mean, I sort of did English at university, smoked too much dope, had too many boyfriends, you know, came off the rails a bit, and went to work as a journalist in my 20s, but was always reading, 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 and never, ever, ever thought of myself as a... I never thought one day I'm going to be an author. By 30, I was definitely starting to kind of dabble with scripts and short stories, and I thought at one point I ran a comedy club with a friend in Kensal Rise, and I thought maybe I'd write I'd be a comic writer, and I was obsessed with Mary Tyler Moore and all those Jewish American comedies and soaps. So at 30, I'd been dabbling, and then I got seriously, seriously ill with something called Churg-Strauss syndrome, and that put me in bed for a year, and on crutches and on painkillers, and it really took the wind out of my sails. You know, it was an existential life check. When I recovered from that, I mean, it was probably 18 months later that I was walking again. I went to Jerusalem. And in Jerusalem, I had many adventures, one of which was meeting a very famous writer. It was meeting this writer that made me think to myself, oh, I think I'm going to do that now. And when I got back, and I must have been about 32, 33, I started working for Amnesty International, and they had a writing group. And it's interesting because the illness combined with working for Amnesty kind of altered my work ethic. Prior to that, I think I'd been, you know, the average wage slave, get on the tube, go to work, clock in, clock out, have a weekly wage. And then getting ill, I was basically disabled for about 18 months to 2 years. When I got back from all of that and I went to work for Amnesty and the culture, the work ethic at somewhere like that, where you've got people who are exiled academics of very high stature, who are basically photocopying, volunteering, working for free, taking a massive wage cut. It was vocational career. So high status and high this, but low that, you know, which is not the way around of the world I'd been living in before. So I basically started writing. I started going to writing classes in my early 30s. Very, very quickly, I was doing an MA, and very quickly, after I came back from Jerusalem, I was writing my first novel.
So, in fact, you were writing Sundog, your first novel, at Lancaster, or even before, weren't you? And was this your first go at a novel?
Yeah.
Or did you have a couple already in the drawer?
No. Mm-hmm. I do have one or two in the drawer, but not that. But Sundog was my first novel. You know, I basically had the idea, got onto the course at Lancaster. Actually, what happened at Lancaster in the first term, I'd been writing just short stories. It was a very talented class. My particular year was very, very high standard. And this young man came back from China, and his name's Justin Hill. He's a writer. He's a really good friend of mine. We'd been pussyfooting around a bit with a few short stories here and there. And about 3 or 4 weeks into our first term, Justin Hill put the first chapter of a novel on the table. It was called The Drink and Dream Tea House, which has subsequently went on to get a massive advance and win loads of awards. And Justin put that chapter on the table. And I remember looking at it and going home and thinking, right, he's put the bar right up here. I'm going home, I'm going to start Sundog. And the next week I had Sundog. I started writing Sundog, and then we were literally neck and neck, me and Justin, handing in chapters and having some group feedback. And I left Lancaster 9 months later with, you know, at least half a novel. And I finished it quite... I sold it the year later, I think.
So you were basically picked up and published more or less straight out of Lancaster.
Yeah.
That's what every creative writing student dreams of, I suppose. But you know, how did it happen?
Well, you see, things are different. I think things must have been different then, but... You know, when you do an MA like that, you get agents always come, don't they? They come picking and looking. Simon Truin was my first agent, and he just happened to visit. And, of course, my tutor had mentioned me that I was writing a novel, and he kind of chatted to me and gave me his card. I'll never forget, I wrote to him and said, oh, dear Simon, you know, writing a magical realism, a tale of magical realism. And he said, he wrote back, and in those days you wrote, you didn't email, you didn't send each other emails. This was in the late 90s. He wrote back and said, dear Miss Roffey, you know, thank you for your two chapters. I'm very interested. However, of course, magical realism is incredibly unpopular and it no longer sells, kind of thing. And, you know, it's really, you know, not quite what I was hoping for. And at that point, I wrote back and said, well, I think that good writing is always fashionable. When I look back at how argumentative I was with the man I was hoping to snare as my agent, and then from there we just took it. I sent him the whole finished product I don't know, a year later or something, he signed me up and we sold it really quickly. That book is very much about my illness. It's about being ill. It's a great big metaphor about surviving, individuating, feeling better after being so ill.
What it enters through is that magical realist element that you talked about, because August's body starts changing with the seasons, doesn't it? He starts developing frost, a rash of frost in the winter, and then he gets, you know, sprouts leaves all over the place in the spring, and then his skin cracks and so on in the summer. Now, as you say, your agent rather said, oh, well, this isn't popular anymore, but you are undeterred, and you say in your memoir that you have a, I quote, almost hallucinatory imagination. So I wonder whether this kind of magic realism just came naturally to you, or were you consciously working in a tradition?
No, I also think it comes from being a Caribbean person. I think that there's definitely a connection that I didn't recognise then, but I recognise now, because my magical realism hasn't disappeared from my work. So Archipelago and The White Woman, you can see traces of the magical realism in those books as well. And when I was settling down to write House of Ashes, I knew that I wanted a magical real feel to it as well, but I don't feel I did pull that off. But I think, yes, I have a very dreamy way of being and thinking and looking at things. And, you know, I sometimes think I've got sort of optic nerves that see things a little bit differently. Big daydreamer. But now, years later, because I wrote that book so long ago now, I think it was my first, you know, you come to write your first novel and pow, you come out of like nowhere and you come out of just this great freshness, and this magical realism is still with me, but much more diluted. I don't think I was writing into a tradition then. It was so raw and natural. But I think if you come from a country where so many things that the European mind would seem impossible or improbable are very common in the Caribbean. You see these crazy juxtapositions, you know, which could be architecture, culture, geography, you know, butting up against each other, that in this country you don't see these things happening. So I've come from a place where you see crazy things and they're normal. So with August, yeah, that things became very, very animated. You know, tables, chairs, cheeses. There was a cheese in that book, the Mimolette, that assumed a character, and things moved.
So you're associating some of that impulse towards magical realism with your Caribbean background, and then also with your illness, because, of course, his body changes. He's no longer in a normal body. And really you were writing out of some, you know, you're making a metaphor or an image out of your own experience.
I mean, at one point when I was ill, my doctor said to me, well, you may never walk again. And I think when you have those moments of being told, you know, you're not special, you're probably going to end up disabled. After that kind of a mortality or reality check, I don't think I've wasted a moment. After that, I was like, oh, right, that's it. So August is becoming well, and it's a transformational process he's going through, which mirrors the process I went through.
His story is a sad one, although it has a happy ending. He's never known his father. His mother won't tell him anything about his real father. When he looks for his father, he discovers that these strange transformations, you know, are a response to his father's death. Now, what I want to ask about this is, what drew you to this story?
Well, I would say the father thing, now that I've written a few books, is, you know, they say something about writers always writing the same book. See, some people have said, oh, Monique always reinvents herself. She always writes something really different. And I'm like, really? You're not looking closely enough at what I'm writing. Because the father, and I lost my father 22 years ago, is something that appears big in all my books. So Sundog is all about paternity, somebody trying to find who their real father is. In The White Woman and the Green Bicycle, my real parents turn up. George Harwood, very much modelled on my father. Archipelago, father and daughter go sailing, a good father. I don't talk a lot about my father in my memoir, but House of Ashes is all about a leader who's parenting, you know, who's radicalising young men. you know, my father died 22 years ago, and my relationship with him was about as bad as it gets. So I didn't have a good relationship with the father that I did have. When I was writing Sundog, I hadn't got a clue what I was writing about, really. And when I look back, I can see a composite father. There's my father in Cosmo, there's my father in The Good Guy, there's a father in The Crazy Old Man, Cedric. There's about five fathers circulating in that book.
Now, your second novel, The White Woman on the Green Bicycle, is the story of George and Sabine Harwood, an Englishman and his unconventional French wife, who come to Trinidad in the late 50s, just as white rule is ending. And George instantly loves Trinidad mm-hmm. and never wants to return to England, where you would have to live a very sort of dim, pinched life instead of the vivid and comfortable one that he has there. Mm. Whereas Sabine can't stand the heat, and especially she can't stand the burden of colonial guilt. Mm. And under the burden of this conflict and of George's infidelities as well, their marriage slowly declines, but they never stop loving each other, and all George wants is to win back Sabine's respect. And when he dies, she's left bereft. Now, your own father was English and your mother French, and your father, you say in your memoir, died in the same way that George dies. Mm. And altogether, the story of the Harwoods is based on your parents. Mm. So could you tell us about that, to what extent it is, and how you've developed it into a fiction?
Again, you know, I was less of a conscious craftsperson then, but I think, it all started with this idea of mum and dad arriving with this green bicycle, which, you know, Trinidad's not like the Netherlands. You don't see people riding around, let alone white people. So it struck me as this crazy other time that a woman like, and my mother, who's 83 now, she was very, very, very beautiful, blonde, white, green-eyed sex pot, no bra, shorts, cycling around on this bicycle in Port of Spain, which no white woman would do. No one would really do this. And it seemed sort of like a different time that she could make such a big mistake that she would even think of doing anything like that. I have used my parents. They were married forever. They were married for 40 years. And they were very, very happily married and matched and loved each other till the day my father died. And so at the heart of this is a love story. It doesn't necessarily happen so much in my generation, but I've always admired it in my parents' generation of couples who stayed together for a very, very long time, come hell or high water. And I know my parents had a love relationship, and it never died. They were still arguing, and they were still talking to each other till the day he died. And my mother's never had another partner, never had another lover. She was 24 when they married. She was 62 when he died, and she's 84 now. It's a long, long, long time to be faithful to one love affair. And that's my kind of template. She's French speaking, but she spoke Arabic, French, Italian. She was European, and she came to this country that she did not understand. She'd come from Egypt, where there was also a very, very diverse culture, Jew, Arab, Christian, all living together. But her theory is that in Egypt, before the war, before the Nakba, the catastrophe of the Palestinians being driven off their land, she said nobody was necessarily best friends, but they all observed each other's customs, they kind of left each other alone, people didn't necessarily integrate, but everybody was on equal footing. Everybody spoke a little bit of Arabic, Hebrew, English, whatever it was it took to get by, to make a diverse culture knit together, even European people who were seen as settlers, not colonisers. So Mum arrived from Egypt to Trinidad on her green bicycle, you know, cycling around as what she felt was a person who understood diverse culture. She spoke various languages. She wasn't white, she was olive-skinned. She sort of thought, I will understand Trinidad, I will get this. And she never did, and she still to this day never did and never does. She didn't get it, she didn't fit in. She felt constantly rejected, and she still does. They've stayed 60 years. So my family got knitted up into the culture of a country, a small country. They were only supposed to stay 4 years. my father was, you know, one of the last of the old colonials. I mean, he was never part of the ruling class. He wasn't in politics or in the civil service of any kind, but he was one of these mavericks who come to the Caribbean, and that's it. He was never going to go back to be... He knew what his lot was. He knew the choices, you know. He'd go back to working 9 to 5 for his entire life.
I want to ask you one last thing, because there is one important element in your work that we haven't talked about, and we really should, and that's to do with the language in your books, and the way in which, in the Trinidadian books, in the Trinidad books, and the way in which you manage to convey Caribbean language. And it's a notoriously difficult thing to do in the novel, you know, write dialect. But the way that you convey Caribbean speech is lively and it's witty and it's not condescending, because that's the real risk of it, isn't it? And it isn't at all. And what I want to ask is whether there's a shared and understood way of doing this amongst Caribbean writers, or whether you developed your own method, your own technique of rendering it. And I also want to ask how you pronounce that marvellous word.
Stjups.
Yes, how Stjups. Do you say it?
Stjups. Do you know something? Caribbean dialect, like any dialect, be it Scots, Welsh, you name it, cannot be attempted successfully by people who are not Caribbean. That's all I can say. I know I have an English accent, but I've grown up with this musical language, this dialect. I've grown up with it. It's in my head, it's in my ear. It can be on my tongue sometimes. It used to be on my tongue. You cannot use it. You cannot write it unless you know it. I don't ever feel that I have to kind of construct it, because it's like living, like most Caribbean people are bilingual. They speak standard English and they speak dialect. Some Caribbean people are trilingual, like, you know, the people who come from the Dutch islands. They speak Papiamento, they speak Dutch, and they might speak English. So my brother speaks dialect. His children speak dialect. My mother speaks dialect when she wants to, because she's a great linguist. So I never think, oh, I've got to write a bit of dialect now. How am I going to do it? It's completely...
It's natural.
Yeah.
Like the magic realism, really. All right, so you've told me how to pronounce, say it again.
Stjups.
Stjups.
A Stjups.
A Stjups.
Yeah.
Right, can you do it?
Yeah, you just suck your teeth together like this. And it's a show of disapproval. When somebody's said something stupid or said something too many times, you just go, and you just suck your teeth. And it's a bit like saying, oh God, you know, yeah.
That's wonderful. Thank you very much. Thank you, Monique, for the whole interview.
Thank you.
That was Monique Roffey in conversation with Carol Angier. You can find out more about Monique on her website at moniqueroffey.com. That's Roffey spelt R-O-F-F-E-Y. And that concludes episode 96, which was recorded by Carol Angier and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 97, the poet and biographer Julia Copus explores the way that poetry, through its control of language, can influence the perception of time. And the playwright and poet Bazir Kazmi considers the stage of the mind and whether the real measure of a playwright is the script as written word. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.